Hello and welcome to the Girls Fuel podcast. My name is Haley. I'm a registered dietitian and nutrition coach here to help you along your health and fitness journey by providing evidence and experience-based knowledge and full transparency. We have a lot to chat about today. I am joined by my colleague, friend, and she was one of my first coaches, actually, Kelly Igo. Kelly, would you do us the honor of introducing yourself?
Absolutely. So Haley, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to chat with you today and to give you guys a little background on who I am. So I'm currently studying for my registered dietitian exam. I graduated with my master's in nutrition and health promotion back in May. I have a bachelor's in science and nutritional science, and I've been coaching online for about 7 years now, which sounds crazy. I am a head coach on Team Mahaley, and I absolutely love what I do. I love all things nutrition, all things fitness, bodybuilding, gut health, and really excited to be here with Haley today.
Kelly is honestly amazing. I say this to people all the time, and I don't know if I've said this to you in a while. You were my favorite coach that I literally ever had.
Oh,
I worked with Kelly, oh gosh, it was years ago now after I competed a couple times, and it was just like the best fit, and I had so much fun. Kelly, I feel like you do a really awesome job, not only understanding the science of what's actually going on in your clients' bodies, but actually getting to know them, meeting them where they're at, and helping them navigate some of the mental hurdles related to their goals. So that's really what we're here to talk about today. We're gonna really help you connect the link between gut health and mental health. And I know, Kelly, you also have a lot of clients that have GI issues, and I do too. And I notice a link between stress, maybe disordered relationships with food, and the gut. So let's, you know, dive on in. And Kelly, I'm going to have you answer our first question of, you know, can you explain the link between mental health and gut health, and why is it particularly relevant for women?
Yes, absolutely. So what's really cool right now in the space that we're involved in, there is so much research evolving, and we're learning every day more and more about the role that our gut plays within our entire body, but especially our mental health. So our gut is quite literally our second brain, is what we're referring to it now. And we actually have a nervous system in our gut called the enteric nervous system. And this enteric nervous system communicates with your central nervous system, which is your brain. So your brain is a part of that central nervous system. And you have something called your HPA axis, your hypothalamus part of your brain. And that part of your brain communicates with your enteric nervous system, vice versa. And about 90% of our serotonin is produced in the gut. So for those that experience stress, anxiety, depression, things of that nature, mental illness, mental health related concerns, there can be a strong connection in the gut. Now, I will say this, not every mental disorder is necessarily driven by the gut, but there can be some sort of relationship happening there. And we're finding more and more that people that have IBS commonly also have anxiety. And it's kind of like chicken or the egg situation we're trying to figure out right now. So that relationship is evolving. We're learning more and more about it each day. But it's incredibly cool to see what we can do from a coaching perspective when it comes to catering to the health of the gut and seeing how that can transition to better mental health, ultimately for people. So that's, in a nutshell, the relationship we see there.
Definitely. And I like how you said, is it the chicken or the egg? Because I find for a lot of clients that I get coming to me with all of these GI issues, once, you know, you start getting to know them, we realize how much either their gut symptoms impacts their mental health. And I've definitely been there to where it's like, you stress over whether you pooped or not, you're in pain, you're afraid to go out to eat because you're going to poop your pants or whatever it is. Or there's just that disconnect where we don't necessarily realize how stressed we actually are. And that is causing these GI issues. So Kelly, what do you see in practice with your clients where everyday stress or even chronic stress influences the gut? What might that look like?
Yeah, so it can look like physical stress. So over-exercising, under-eating, just even like physical stress if you have a laborious job. So if like you're out there, like my boyfriend works in sheet metal, he's working hard all day, like his body's under more stress than mine sitting at a computer. But that said, my psychological stress could be higher. So there's also the caveat to that. psychological stress impacts your gut health, your motility. I would say the number one reason I see gut issues for people is stress driven. It's stress related. Commonly, there is a component of psychological stress and physical stress with the people I work with. But I do see that sometimes it can be solely just the physical stress or solely just the psychological, but has a major impact. And we see a lot of constipation that leads to things like SIBO, candida, all these crazy things that can take place when you're just not pooping regularly. And so it's really important to be going to the bathroom regularly, having normal bowel movements. So that's typically what I see in practice.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I always tell my girls, I'm like, as long as you're pooping, that is what matters most. I honestly don't even care if it's a little bit on the looser side, if you're prone to constipation, as long as we have something happening every day to get those toxins, that leftover food, whatever it is, out of your system. Because like Kelly mentioned, whatever stress is in your so-called stress bucket, and I know you don't have to feel stressed to be stressed. This is actually something that I'll share I'm working through right now, where, and I'm not sure if any of you can relate to this, where my nervous system just feels active. Right? Like, I'm not sure if you ever try to relax, so to speak, and you just can't. Your brain keeps going or your body feels tense. You feel the need to move. That is stress right there. And that's where we may need to peel back some layers. And this is where obviously therapy is a great tool for that, but coaching can also come in handy. And I'm going to ask Kelly in a minute about some of her stress management tactics that she uses with clients. But when our body is in that constant, almost fight or flight sensation, cortisol is likely a little bit higher. That's where we'll see a slowdown in motility. GI bowel movements are going to be happening less frequently. Secretions are going to slow down. So you may have low digestive enzyme production. And that's where we often will see food intolerance like symptoms pop up. And we start wondering, well, what food is my trigger food? And all of these things, when for some clients, if we catch that stress early enough, we can prevent those downstream issues and stop it before you have some sort of infection. So Kelly, if I'm your client, I'm coming to you and I'm clearly a ball of stress. I have a lot going on. I'm having trouble regulating my nervous system. What are some specific stress management strategies that you found can have a positive impact on gut health?
Yeah, so I really am a big proponent of deep breathing, breath work. And I know I'm going to get eye rolls as you're listening to this podcast. I know sometimes my clients will be like, yeah, okay, I'm not going to do that. But let me tell you, I recently just went through probably the most stressful phase of my entire life, balancing my internship, grad school, and still working full time. I don't recommend, but I did that. And so for me, I was in a very similar place as Haley is right now, where I was just constantly stressed. My body was not loving it. So I started to incorporate daily 5 to 10 minute meditation practices because, number one, I don't have a whole lot of time. Most people don't. And I think 5 minutes is doable for me. I can sit there for 5 minutes and be quiet. And I like using a guided meditation because if I don't have somebody talking me through it, my brain just goes elsewhere. So I find the guided meditation to be helpful, but to each their own. You might thrive with a very quiet, peaceful meditation. And I would say the guided are still peaceful, but it helps you to kind of work through your thoughts. They tell you how to breathe. And if you're not interested in the meditative practice, you could still do deep breathing. And so when people are open to that, I'll say, okay, let's do 4 to 8 cycles of deep breathing in the morning and at nighttime. I like it in the morning because most people are stressed upon waking. We got to get up, we got to get to work, we got to get on the road, all that. And then at night, it can be really hard to quiet your brain. So that's why I like it at night as well. Kind of brings the body into our rest and digest state, also known as our parasympathetic state. So that's what the deep breathing does. It's one of the most effective things you can do, and it's free. And that's why I love it. And I, you know, I'm sure Haley and I have a lot of similarities with how we practice with our clients and approach supplementation and nutrition. I like to use minimal amount of supplements with people. It's expensive, and I want your body to do the things on its own as much as it can. So I like to bring in that deep breathing, and it's really effective. You could also do it before meals. And I do have some people do it. I know it's not always practical. So this is where things get tricky. If I could have like perfect laboratory, I'd have everybody do it before meals. I'd have people do it in the morning and at night, but that's not realistic. But if you can, bringing your body into that parasympathetic state before a meal can be so helpful. And I find that another great tool for my really stressed individuals is putting the phone away at nighttime or creating better boundaries with it. So if you have a job where maybe you're on call, like if you're a doctor and you need to be on call, maybe you can't really put the phone away. But when you have an opportunity to step away from the phone, try to take the break from scrolling. Try to take a break from looking at your email or text messages that could be stressful. Just trying to decrease the activity that we're seeing with the phone, because that's interpreted as stress, and that's a modern day stressor. Our body's not well equipped to handle quite yet. We're still slow in evolution. So that is one thing I like to try to promote, like stop your scrolling. The mindless scrolling is not helping. And also thinking about like what you're viewing on social media, because that can impact your stress too. Another really awesome tool for people can be journaling if they're open to it. This isn't going to work for everybody. Some people, they're just not going to be into it, and that's fine. I've been doing a lot more journaling with my clients, and I feel like it's helping. And it gives us a point of conversation to work through some of the stressors so we can better support them and meet them where they're at. Additionally, I will pull training down. So for that physical stress component, and that's a hard one. I hate doing it, but I got to do it sometimes. So I'll bring the training down like 2 to 3 days a week if I need to. And we'll use reps in reserve training style, because a lot of my clients who are healthy, they will train to failure. When you have gut issues, we're not training to failure. It's too much on the body. So we do a reps in reserve style, bring the training down so your body can spend more time in that parasympathetic state, your rest and digest state. So those would be a few tips. Cardio as well, I'll pull that down. Use light intensity, steady state cardio. That can be really helpful. And then lastly, making sure you're getting enough nutrition in. So you want to make sure that your body has enough nutrition to heal and know that it's safe. And so that's another stress mitigation tactic. So not being in a deficit when trying to fix your gut issues, because that'll really just work against you. So those would be a few of my favorite go-to stress management tips.
I love all of those and do utilize every single one of them with my clients as well. The breathing, it really is the biggest game changer. And I catch myself now just doing it randomly all the time. I do it when I'm driving, which if you're somebody that gets really stressed out in traffic, I recommend it. But I like to do it especially before bed. Sleep is kind of a point of stress for me, and that's something I struggle with. So if there is a point that you can identify and you're acknowledging the feeling where your body's tensing up, maybe your heart rate feels like it's going a little bit faster. If you have anxiety, I'm sure you know what this feels like. And that's where, while you might not always feel stressed, building awareness around that heightened sense of your nervous system can be really helpful. So you know how to look inward and say, hey, maybe I do need this 5 minutes. And if you are someone that's a little bit more not into the meditation apps, because I wasn't for a while, now I will use them. I just have a playlist that's called like Meditation Beats, and there's no one talking because that annoys me sometimes. I'm like, I don't want to hear your voice. It's just songs that are quiet. But sometimes I'll just count backwards in my head while I'm breathing. This is what I'll do before bed. I'll start at 30 because it's not too high. And as I'm doing deep breaths, I'll go 30, you know, 29, 28, and slowly start to relax different muscles in my body. So you start getting in tune. Are you relaxing your toes or are you clenching them? Are you relaxing your ankles or are you clenching them? So that can be something that's helpful if you have a hard time, you know, turning your brain off, but it's going to be person to person. Like Kelly, I'm sure when you start a new client, you do an intake of, you know, well, what is your morning routine like? What is your evening routine like? And get a sense of, are you rushing around with your meals? Can we sit down and eat breakfast, even if it's only for 5 minutes, instead of doing it in the car? And just identifying small little windows to get your body out of this rush, 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 fight or flight state can make a massive difference in your day to day. Or even, I like how you said the phone. I personally notice my energy is crash if I'm scrolling in the morning.
I feel the same, like the more and more, and I'm sure like to working on your phone, like your phone is a sense of work, whether it's Instagram, email, whatever. And so for me, it's like, I need to get away from the phone to be done working. And I find that that's a big problem for myself. It's like, it's hard for me to put the phone down. But when I do, I feel better. It's like a weight lifted off my shoulders. So I'm right there with you.
Sleeping is just so much easier. Another tool that I'm a huge fan of is blue light blocking glasses. I have the ridiculous ones that are literally like deep red tinted shade, and it's amazing. I notice a huge difference with my sleep, because if we're blocking that blue light production, our melatonin is going to be able to be produced a little bit easier, especially if you are someone that has to work late, has to be on your computer or your phone late at night, or even I just like to watch TV at night. Like that is how I unwind. It is still a screen, but it's not right in my face, and it is still somewhat being blocked by that blue light. And everything, you know, Kelly mentioned with the management of stress, take it one step at a time. You know, choose one of those things to look into and start practicing. And you may not notice anything right away, but especially the more and more that you can, you know, essentially put some pennies in the jar of checking off those actions, the better you're going to feel too.
Absolutely. One thing I wanted to add, I think you might find this to be interesting. So I recently got a red light, like mask thing for, it's for clean air, but it actually, like I was reading into it because I'm like so interested. I'm like freaking out about it. And it can help with the melatonin production due to the red light. And I've noticed for me, I am actually feeling calm when I have it like on. I don't know if it's a little placebo, but I find that I'm falling asleep easier. So maybe there's something to that using the red light as well for like people that are more anxious and things. I guess it can increase serotonin. So that's one little new tidbit I learned.
I feel like red light, everything is really hot right now. Like I get ads on Instagram all the time and it's like red light 10, red light bulb. And I'm like, huh.
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's interesting. It's like how crazy we can do so much with just exposure to certain light throughout the day. I think it's awesome. So
it is, it is. And I kind of want to move the conversation a little bit to a certain population. Mm-hmm. I find that females that have a history of disordered eating or eating disorders especially end up having some GI issues. And that can make it especially challenging to get your calorie intake up. That can make it especially challenging to get to that, you know, next step of recovery. And I know this is a population that you do work closely with. So I'd love to hear maybe some tips that you use with this population to help them overcome some of these GI issues and where you start.
Yeah. So really great question. And most of the individuals that I work with currently, they're not in a place where they're deep into their eating disorder. They're mostly recovered. They might be working through some binge eating here and there triggered by stress. But aside from that, it's not like an inpatient level care or residential. So a little bit different in terms of the way that they might approach it versus how I do. So I just wanted to explain that. I do think for these individuals that have had a history of disordered eating, I see very commonly, they are the ones that have IBS diagnoses, right? And some of these people can make a big improvement in their digestion from what I've learned through just bringing down the exercise volume and the intensity, bringing those physical stressors down because their body has taken note on what they've done in the past. And if they've had a history of, say, anorexia or compulsive exercising, your body's going to remember that. And so it really does adapt and respond. And so that keeps it in a more stressed state. So I find for my people that have had a history of eating disorder, when they're engaging in their fitness journey at a healthy level, they really can't go super intense or they experience amenorrhea or the digestive flare-ups. So we do a lot of reps and reserve style training with those individuals. Also light intensity, steady state cardio when utilizing that, if I'm utilizing it. I also find for these people, journaling is huge because continuing a lot of those therapeutic practices in real time, like even when you feel like you're all good, you want to keep some of that practice in. And I find that for those individuals, those types of lifestyle factors will help. I will say this. Some people, if they've had a very severe eating disorder where they were using like enemas, laxative abuse, things of that nature, sometimes you don't make a full comeback. And not to be negative, but you might not be able to like go to the bathroom every day. Your norm might be every other day or every 2 days. And like, that's better than like 3 weeks without a bowel movement. And I've seen people go from like literally 2.5, 3 weeks, no bowel movement to like going every other day. And they're like, I'm really happy with that. And I'm happy with that too. And so they're not on Linzess, which is like a medication. I know Haley knows it, but like that's a medication that can help you go to the bathroom. And so we come off these things and we're trying to just get the body to do it on its own. Everybody's baseline is going to look different when you've had, say, an ED past. But I do see that most people can get to a normalized place, but normal looks different for everybody. I will bring in some supplementation. I find that for a lot of these people, the smooth muscles in the gut just like aren't, they're not doing their thing like they should be. They're always feeling like they have more to go. They have slow motility after going through multiple kind of gut protocols, addressing like potential overgrowth of gut dysbiosis or SIBO, candida. We go through all those things and we're still having motility issues. And so I'll bring in something called Motilla Pro, which I find to work really well. I learned a lot from my mentors, Jason Theobald and Austin Stout. I took a few of their gut health classes. I know Haley's familiar with both, and Justin Mahaley as well. And so I've had a lot of experience through them. And that's where I kind of get these supplement recommendations and where I've tried them. And I found really great success with that. So that's one of my favorites to use with this population when I'm finding like the motility is just not where it needs to be. Additionally, so with these people, really focusing on getting a diverse amount of bacteria in the gut is huge. So variety of food sources, which depending on your history can be really challenging because if you have these fears of food, and that's why I say I work with mostly people that are like pretty well recovered or they're in the place where they're like really open to that part of recovery, because that's a really important part. So having the diversity of foods can help. I find that when people come from a restrictive history, they have more food intolerances because they just haven't been exposing the gut, the bacteria diversity is lacking, things of that nature. And also food volume is something to consider. So some people are big volume eaters when they're in their eating disorder and they'll have done a number on their digestive system through that. So working through lower volume feeding can help with the motility. You want to get enough fiber, just not too much. So it's like this perfect little balance. So that in a nutshell would be kind of like my overview of typically the things I see in that population and how we work through it. One of my teachers, Marcy Evans, and if you're interested, Haley, I'd love to send you this info.
Yeah.
She is like so into the research right now of the gut and eating disorders and seeing if like there is a predisposition in terms of eating disorder behavior and like the gut, like kind of like the gut causing part of the pre-genetic predisposition, which is really interesting. And also she's really deep into figuring out how can we get the gut back to normal after something like an eating disorder where you have been in such a famine state, malnourished state, those gut muscles aren't working, things of that nature. So she's a great point of reference for anybody looking for more content like that.
I would definitely love to look into that a little bit more. And I like how you specified what population specifically you work with. And that's how we are as well. My assistant coach, Zoe, and I, we will not necessarily work with anybody that is actively in recovery. We do have referral networks if anybody does need support. But I find with that population, or even just women that have had gut issues for 10, 20 years, which is a lot of what I get, especially recently, a lot of women who have been through the whole doctor shebang of colonoscopies, finding nothing. And you know how that goes. And I don't share this to bash doctors by any means. I think they just look at things quite differently than maybe we would, taking a more holistic, full body approach. And I find that that motility piece is big. And once you can get that back to what your new normal will look like, that will likely reduce a lot of discomfort. So one thing that this sounds so silly and you're going to roll your eyes probably, that I start everybody with if they're comfortable, even if they're not comfortable, we're going to try, is eating something for breakfast. I do not care if you eat one bite of it. I don't care if you eat the whole thing, but we need to get something into your digestive tract, ideally within the first hour, hour and a half of waking. I find that a lot of my ladies that are dealing with like distension, like pregnancy level bloating, that can be really challenging because if you're waking up bloated, it's not going to feel great to eat. But I have found with tons of clients, even when I was dealing with bloating a couple of years ago with SIBO, which we're going to talk about what all of these SIBOs and candidas mean in a second, is it makes a big difference because I find a lot of times when we have that bloating, it is often a result of our bodies not having enough of what they need. Right. So kind of like Kelly mentioned with making sure we're actually nourishing our gut. If we don't, if you're not regularly feeding your body every few hours or just enough calories for the day, everything slows down. And that's just a protective mechanism, right? We can dive deeper if we want to into thyroid slowing down and all of that, but motility slows down. Your body's not digesting anything as quickly. So yes, it is going to feel like it's sitting there. And that's where I'll do some at-home tests with my clients. Like, I don't know if you use the baking soda burp test.
Okay. I actually saw you post about that.
Love
and
it.
I learned about it in school. I haven't yet to deploy it, but I'm like, oh, she uses it in real practice. Yes. So maybe one day I'll get a chance to.
All the time. And you should do it yourself. It's super easy. So I did a post on this that I can share if you're interested. But basically what the baking soda burp test does is it assesses your stomach acid levels. So stomach acid is a fun concoction or gastric juices of, you know, HCL, which will help us digest protein, other gastric juices, bile, and things that are going to help us break down our macronutrients. So those stomach acid levels get depressed very easily from stress, from not eating enough, and from infection. You will not have enough stomach acid. But sometimes what low stomach acid feels like is acid reflux or bloating or gas. So especially if you go to the doctor for this, they're probably going to put you on a PPI or a proton pump inhibitor for high acid or acid reflux, which I see far too often. And if you are on a proton pump inhibitor and you aren't sure if you should be, let's chat. I help clients wean off of them all the time with the help of their doctor. But if you don't have that stomach acid because you're skipping breakfast, your body doesn't know that it needs it. Mm-hmm. So by having breakfast, not only are you starting the peristalsis, the contractions of the stomach muscles, you're starting the digestive enzyme production, which starts in our mouth with salivary amylase. Just the thought of food, the anticipation, can start those enzymes being produced. So by having breakfast regularly, even again, if that's uncomfortable for you and you have one bite of something or one sip of a liquid meal, that is going to start that digestive process and get things moving for the rest of the day instead of leaving both your nervous system and your GI tract in that stress state. I have clients all the time, especially those who have eating disorder histories, where that's where we start. And bloating is like within a week, significantly better. So that is one thing that everybody's like, oh yeah, my mom tells me to eat breakfast. Well, this is us telling you to eat breakfast. I don't care what it is. And then, you know, build it up to something that is super nourishing once you get comfortable eating at that time. But that is one thing that I found like a night and day difference. Because I find if you're going to poop, it's usually going to be in the morning. And I don't know about you, I can't poop until I eat something.
That's so funny. That's such a good point too, because it's like something that can be so easily overlooked. Like you might just assume somebody's having breakfast, like they're having meal one, but it's like, when are you having meal one? Is it like 4 hours after waking? So yeah, I think that regular meal timing is huge for that motility. So I love that tip. That's awesome.
Yeah, that is always the first place that I start. I mean, we get busy, right? You get busy, you have your kids, you're running out the door. So that's where, you know, I'll work with my clients to find like a super, super easy, high protein for their needs breakfast that can be on the go if it needs to. And Kelly, I know we've mentioned a couple times SIBOs and infections, and I kind of want to clear that up for some people. So do you want to talk us through kind of the progression that you usually see where people end up with some of these more severe GI infections?
Yeah. So with SIBO, I find that this is really common in my people that have just had chronic motility issues. So they're constipated. They're very bloated. One of my favorite questions to ask somebody when I'm like trying to figure out if they have SIBO, I'm like, do you get really bloated after drinking water in the morning? And it's like the light bulb goes off. They're like, yes, after drinking water. And so you're just in this chronic state of like balloon belly is what I like to call it. Your belly's filled up with air. It's uncomfortable. You're experiencing that constipation. You might not feel fully alleviated with certain bowel movements. It typically is presenting mostly as constipation, but I will say it can also swing the other way once you start treating it, which is always a fun time for the person going through it. But that's typically what I see, and it's from chronic constipation. And I find a lot of the time with the population that I work with, it's due to some sort of stress response that's happened over time and was just never properly addressed. So it progressed to this small intestinal bacterial overgrowth situation. And so it typically takes time to get there. And to be preventative of it is to get that constipation addressed as soon as possible. Because when you have that stool undigested food sitting in your gut when it's not supposed to be, that's when problems get created. So when things are where they're not supposed to be, that's when problems arise, and that drives the inflammation up. So not only are you inflamed in your gut, but that can actually lead to systemic inflammation. So then you're feeling inflamed and all over. Energy levels can be really low. Brain fog can be a problem, depending on how severe the inflammation is over time. Absorption issues can take place, which makes you feel crappy because then you're not absorbing the nutrients that your body needs. You're not getting energy from your food. So that's commonly where I see SIBO mostly develop in terms of that situation. What about you, Haley?
Yes, I agree. SIBO often starts, you know, with that kind of cascade of, okay, you know, IBS-like symptoms. And at least a lot of my population at one point had been diagnosed with IBS. And at least in my opinion, I'm curious how you feel about this. IBS is almost just like a blanket statement for there's a lot going on in your gut. We don't entirely know the root cause of it. Obviously, we know some of the big signs and symptoms or symptomology of IBS as like hypermotility or, you know, contractions causing pain and gas and all these different things. But we also have to look at like the immune system and where that plays a role and impacts the alterations in the GI tract, because that long-term GI issues, and a lot of my clients that come to me because what I'm specializing in now is gut health, usually have a very long history of gut health issues that might've been brushed off. Right. So I get a lot of clients that I'm like, hey, take me back as long as you can remember having issues. And they're like, I think whenever the kid, I had lactose intolerant, or I was really constipated as a kid, I had to go to the hospital. I also get a lot of clients that have autoimmune related conditions, which we know that everything's connected, right? Like 60%+ of our immune function lies in our gut, like Kelly mentioned in the very beginning. So we don't tell you these things to frighten you, more so to empower you to a place where if you have feel like you've done everything, you've gone to the doctor, you've tried the fiber, maybe you're relying on laxatives and you're still not feeling what you know as 100%, to dig deeper. Because I find a lot of my ladies that have had gut issues for a long time, and that doesn't only mean constipation, that is the most common one that I see, but there are other signs and symptoms of a GI issue that aren't just in your gut. So feeling like you always have seasonal allergies, post-nasal drip, itchy skin, dry eyes and dry mouth. What is it called when your tongue is really white? Oral thrush.
Thrush, yes.
Mm-hmm. I had that. That was fun. Yeah, and all of these different things, it likely is more than IBS. And that's where you can ask your doctors to test you for SIBO. That one is going to be a breath test that a lot of doctors can do. That is not necessarily the gold standard of testing, but it's a good place to start. H. pylori is another one that I see a lot. That's going to be an inflammatory bacterial infection. There is a breath test for that as well. But especially for my ladies that know they have immune system issues, maybe you're always getting sick, you have that autoimmune component, it isn't a bad idea to do some more advanced testing like a GI map stool test to rule out other bacterial pathogens and overgrowth, parasites, and just deficits within your GI tract function. Right? Because we have to remember our GI tract isn't just our stomach and our intestines. We have our accessory organs like our liver and our gallbladder and our pancreas. And if those aren't doing their job, then digestion isn't going to be optimal. And I like how in the beginning you were like minimal effective dose with supplements. And that's how I approach it as well. I'll usually start with like a super in-depth GI questionnaire that kind of assesses each organ and how it's doing and where there might be gaps. And from there, you know, the first month of coaching may look like dietary changes to simplify things, to make digestion easier, maybe some supportive supplements. Maybe we'll do the baking soda burp test, which I totally lost my train of thought and never finished what that was, did I?
No, I think you did. I think you did a great job. You explained how you use it and like when it's appropriate to do it, and it kind of tells you about the low stomach acid and people are inappropriately prescribed the PPI. Yes. That's how we can use it to our advantage. No, you crushed that. That's awesome.
Thank you for taking us back full circle. I'm such a squirrel on these podcasts. I'm like, we're talking about this and now we're talking about this and now we're over here.
That's always me on a podcast. I feel like, no, you did great. You explained it beautifully. Everybody here listening will agree. So yes.
No, definitely. And Kelly, what do you find is like the most helpful tool for your clients when it comes to overcoming their GI issue? Hard question. Okay.
So people are probably going to hate this, but it's literally called stress management, patience, and monitoring, like very close monitoring. So with my gut health clients, especially when I'm starting with them and I'm really trying to get them back to a healthier baseline, I update with them every day, Monday through Friday. And I'm asking them, when are you going to the bathroom? When are your symptoms coming up? What are your stools presenting like? So I get to learn a lot about their digestion and what is normal to them. And they also have the opportunity to kind of learn like about what their normal is, because most people don't know. Like they might know they have gut issues that they're uncomfortable, but they don't really know what's causing it. So usually within like the first week, we can kind of identify like, here are some food sources that are really triggering. So I will use a low FODMAP diet. My practice with this is changing a bit as of recent, like past 3 months. So this is really recent. I am hesitant to go strict low FODMAP with most people because of the mental side of things. And I personally, knock on wood, I've been very grateful, very lucky. I haven't had gut issues, but I know for me, if I was going to be put on a low FODMAP diet, like I can only do it for so long without going hard. Crazy. And I know, and I have people that I work with right now where they're so inflamed and they're so severe. We have to, and we have to like think about it as a very short-term thing. And that's how it should be used, is short-term. But sometimes I won't go full low FODMAP, but I'll say, let's study the digestion, see what foods are causing flare-ups. We'll pull those out and take note of that for right now, as we're typically going through elimination phase, as like I like to call it. Killing off bad bacteria, whatever it is, fungal overgrowth. And then, you know, we reintroduce around, say, that like 8 to 10 week mark. I find it usually takes at least 8 weeks. I know the standard is like 6. I have yet to see somebody make a turnaround that quick. Wow. So I'd love to hear your thoughts if you've ever seen an elimination phase go that quickly. But I find it takes at least 8 to 10 for most of my people. So
I think it depends. I find that I have two camps people. I am the same way with the low FODMAP diet. It's always like a conversation, like, hey, this is what it looks like. I'm not going to lie to you. It is quite challenging. It's especially challenging to eat out. Now, I have done the low FODMAP diet for a very long period of time while I was killing off SIBO and Candida, which is yeast overgrowth fungal, and all of that. And it's doable. It's possible to have yummy meals while you're doing it. And that's what I always try. I'm sure you're like that too. Try to help my clients do that. Yes. I find those clients that don't need GI map testing. Cause I always get this question. Do you use the GI map yet?
I do, but very sparingly, as I'm sure you probably do too. Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely do. Unless somebody's like, comes to me and they're like, I saw you talk about this. I need it now. I'm like, okay. Let's just try some things. Kind of like you said, there's close communication, there's close monitoring, there's trial and error. And then we come to the decision together. But if I suspect somebody is like very severe inflammation, I'll pull FODMAP foods, usually starting with gluten and dairy, and then we'll go low FODMAP. And I say, we'll do it for 4 weeks, or maybe it's low histamine. It kind of just depends what they need. And during that time, I'll usually add in a couple different supportive supplements based on their symptoms, based on their questionnaires, to support immune function, liver detox, overall digestive capacity. And I have some clients that at the end of that 4 to 6 weeks, they do feel a lot better, and we're able to introduce FODMAPs back in with literally no issue. And what that shows me is if they had an overgrowth, it was so minor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And plus probiotics and everything like that can help balance. However, that is like 10% of my clients. I find 90% of people will start low FODMAP. They'll usually feel a little bit better, but symptoms are still going pretty strong at that point. So that's where we say, hey, testing, let's do it, let's not. And we usually move forward with testing to find the root cause of what's really going on. And that may mean a longer elimination. And I will say, I have literally never had somebody that actually had an infection clear in 6 weeks. Usually it is at least 8 to 12, and it kind of depends on adherence. But one thing I have learned in the last year, year and a half, that I've been really focusing on this type of client, you do not have to be perfect at all. I think when I was learning this from previous mentors, it was like, if your client has one bite of gluten, one glass of wine, like they totally, everything's fermenting again, they totally undid it. And that is so not true, because I can tell you that I was far from perfect when I did it myself. And none of my clients are perfect with it either. So that's where, be a human, right? So whenever my clients have like an event coming up, like we talk about, well, what is that event like? What is the vibe? Who are you going with? What's the food? And how can we adjust it? Typically, if somebody is in a kill off, getting rid of overgrowth, and they are low FODMAP, if they're going out, we'll be like, hey, gluten and dairy and alcohol, avoid those at all costs. And then just do your best, because sometimes you just can't control what's in your food. You may have some symptoms, but you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
And that's how we make it at least somewhat sustainable for that 8 to 12 week. But it does get really hard at the end there. So that's where support is very helpful.
Yes. And especially too, like with the population I'm more and more seeing are people with eating disorder history, and we really don't want to trigger that. So this is like my dilemma. And I'm sure you run into this. It's like, do I prioritize the gut health over the mental? Like, and I'm like, no. And the more and more I learn and grow as a professional, I'm like, mental health is everything. And if mental health is okay, the physical falls into place even better. So I'm so with you on that. It's like I rarely do the super strict low FODMAP now. I'll use that knowledge and educate the clients on it so they can be aware when making food choices. Like, hey, you might get a little gassy if you have this, but as long as you're ready for it, well, we'll go for it. But I definitely think it depends on the person and like where they're at with their relationship with food, how they feel. Like, you know, someone like Haley or myself, like we could probably follow something really strict, but like, are we gonna be happy? No, probably not. And do I suggest that for most people? No, probably not. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough, but it is a tool that you can use.
It is a tool, and that is one route, you know, going more of the holistic functional, doing more of the supplements like herbs and things like that to kill off the bacteria. Again, you don't have to be perfect. So there are some clients that they're like, I cannot live without this food. It's high FODMAP. And I'm like, that is literally fine. If that is one of the only foods that you're going to keep in right now, that's great. There are some cases, though, depending on your history and how much antibiotic use you've had in your past, where if it is not realistic for you to do this protocol, whether it's because of a disordered eating history, whether it's just because of your life, that might be where we say, hey, why don't you go talk to your doctor, get them to confirm the overgrowth and get an antibiotic, and we're going to support the shit out of your GI tract while you do it. And I feel like that's another missing piece. I get a lot of clients that come to me, they're like, my doctor said I had SIBO, my doctor said I had a parasite, and I've done this many rounds of antibiotics and I've never taken a probiotic. And I'm like, ah,
I
that's
know.
horrifying. Oh my God. So supporting your GI tract is like the order of business number one, and then evaluating what approach makes more sense for you to heal. But there are multiple, and that's the thing. You know, there isn't only one way to do things.
That is such a good point to bring up about the antibiotics. Like people forget that that's an option. And like I had a conversation with Justin, like on his podcast about, you know, what if somebody's low income and they can't afford all these supplements? Like, let's be honest, it's freaking
It
expensive
is.
to undergo a holistic approach because you're not getting health insurance coverage. And so when somebody is experiencing like financial difficulty, I'm like, let's go with the antibiotic and we will support you as best we can as you come off and, you know, with the foods and things. But so yeah, there's so many approaches to it. And so if someone's trying to tell you that this is the only way or the highway, get a second opinion because there are multiple approaches.
Definitely, there are. And the biggest thing that I hope this episode drives home is none of those approaches will work without the stress management and mental health component.
It's so important, crucial. I don't want to say more important than say antibiotics or other tools you talked about, but it is at the core. And if you can't get that under control, you could have the best nutrition, the best supplements, the best thing. It's not going to work. So yeah, it's really huge, really huge.
It is, especially I find, I'm sure you get a lot of coaches coming to you for coaching as well. We're the worst, right? We
God.
are the worst at managing our stress. Like, I am not gonna lie, I am the worst. We're all the worst because our job is everywhere, our phones, our computer, we have imposter syndrome, we have all these things. So that's where setting those boundaries, like with screen time, can be really helpful, like Kelly mentioned earlier, and even just like making small changes. One other thing, and I'm curious what you do for this, especially now that you have a little more free time post school, but I always try to help my clients, and this is hard for a lot of us as adults, to find things that they just genuinely like doing that have nothing to do with their phone, that have nothing to do with work. And Kelly, what would you say some of yours are or some of your clients?
Yeah, so I would say from my personal standpoint, and it's nothing that special, but I like hanging out with my boyfriend and like spending time with him, which is something that we've been able to kind of get more of now that I'm done with school. So just quality time with him. I love watching comedy. I'm a big comedy girl. So like, I don't know if you're familiar with Kill Tony, that
I
podcast.
love that. My boyfriend and I
Oh my God.
watch that all the time.
Yes. Okay. So that's like my guilty pleasure. And like when I'm looking to decompress, like John and I, we put on Kill Tony and we just laugh. And like I think laughter is the best medicine. And it's just like, I don't know. That's what saves me is comedy right now. And I also like to do like little self-care things. Like I'll spend extra time with like my jade roller and I don't always use it. I know it doesn't like really change your face structure, but like little things of like self-care, and you know, using like a hair mask, like that makes me feel relaxed. So I will implement tactics like that. And typically, you know, when working with my clients, I'll brainstorm with them like, well, what do you like? What do you enjoy? And we can kind of pinpoint like two or three things that they can gravitate towards and lean on for strategies. And that seems to be helpful, but a lot of self-care, laughing, spending time with people you enjoy that don't stress you out.
I am exactly the same. And I feel like when people think self-care, they think, oh, a spa day or a massage. I'm like, no, you literally don't have to spend any money. You just need to put your phone away. I mean, sometimes I'll play music because I love listening to music. I love listening to like old 2000s. So one of my favorite things to do, and you'll probably never see me doing this with a video on Instagram because I'm not about the dancing videos. I'm very sorry. I can't do it.
Why, Haley? Why not?
I just can't. I just can't do it. But listening to music and like dancing and cooking or cleaning, like obviously cleaning is a task, but I enjoy doing it. It's fun.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So little things like that, or like doing like a little errand running day with a friend, or things like that. I have a couple clients that started playing pickleball with their boyfriends, and I was like, that's awesome because it's movement, but it's not exercise. It's not sets and reps. It's not a heavy mental burden. So anything that you can do to fill your cup, even if it's just 2 minutes of breathing, even if it's 2 minutes of hugging your cat, whatever it is.
Yes, I wanted to add on to that. Pets, if you have pets, they are so therapeutic. There's like more research coming out about how our central nervous system literally just chills when we're with our pet. So lean on your pets. They're great.
You don't have a pet, get a pet.
Yeah, get a pet. It's your excuse now.
It
That's the
is. Yeah. Also, if you like to sing, I don't know if people like to hum or sing, vagal nerve, got to stimulate that, get
Where do
your
you have that?
parasympathetic nervous system going. But I think the biggest thing is, support regularity. And if you don't think you're stressed, but you're having all these issues, especially if you're constipated, or if you get diarrhea immediately upon maybe starting work or getting somewhere or talking to someone, that could be a sign that your nervous system is a little bit on high alert and you might need to identify the root of that stress.
Yeah, and we're really bad at perceiving our true stress, which is something that we can all work on, but that's where having a coach can be nice because they can be objective with it and be like, I can just feel your stress in this check-in. Like, I literally will have moments like that with people. I can sense your stress today,
Yeah,
so
you're like, I'm not that stressed. I'm like, are you sure you're constipated?
you're
Your
making me
period
stressed.
late? What?
I go, you're making me stressed. What do you mean you're not
I
stressed? I
know,
can sense.
right? Oh my gosh. Too funny. Awesome. All right. Well, Kelly, thank you so much. This was so much fun. I already want to have you on again.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This was awesome.
And how can everybody connect with you on the interweb?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Instagram at Kelly Igo, just my name. And I also have a TikTok, but I'm going to be honest, it's very similar to what I post on Instagram. So you can follow me there if you prefer TikTok as well. I also have a podcast that's in the midst of being revamped and rebranded. We'll definitely have Haley on once I get there and it gets restarted. And that's called Barbells, Bikini, and No BS. And that's where you can find my podcast. I have a couple episodes if you're bored, you want to listen to it. And I'm also a part of Team Haley. So we have a Facebook group and you can join that even if you're not a member and you want to gain some access to some freebies and learn some stuff. So yeah, join our Facebook group.
Awesome. And I'll put your Instagram in the show notes for everybody. So that way, if anybody has questions or wants to just share anything, our DMs are always going to be open. And Kelly, thank you so much for coming on. And for those of you listening, thank you for hanging out with us.
Thank you so much.